Hello, and welcome to the Nurses for Healthy Environments podcast, where we talk with nurses working at the intersection of health and environment. My name is Beth Shank, a registered nurse from Missoula, Montana, and host of today's podcast. Today, our guest is Tom Engel. He is a mostly retired public health nurse, and he's involved with a variety of organizations in his areas of interest. He lives and works near Portland, Oregon. Hello, Tom. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Thank you. Tell us about yourself. How did you get started in nursing, and how are you interested in environmental health particularly?
You know, that you look back, I'm old. I'm in almost 70, and so you look back on your life and you think that there was this straight line that got you to where you ended up. But of course, that's not true. To be fair and honest, and I think this is somewhat encouraging to younger people, I lived in this place outside of a college town, and there was, you know, like 30 of us that lived in these three houses, and 30 people and 25 dogs, and five or six of them were a rock and roll band. And the closest place that we could walk to work was a nursing home that was about 2 miles away. So three or four of us became orderlies. That's what we called them back then. And a couple of us became nurse's aides. And we worked at that nursing home. And, you know, I learned a lot from the nurses who were there. But I got to tell you, I can still see these two nurses, Kathy and Rita, standing by the bed of this very, very old, very little African-American man who'd never been visited by anybody. And he's dying, and he's taking his last breath. And they're standing there comforting him in as he takes his last breath over, you know, 15 minutes, 30 minutes. And I just said to myself, well, these guys are really smart and they really care, and I'm going to go do that. So I went off and applied for nursing school and went to nursing school and ended up going to graduate school and became a psychiatric nurse practitioner and did that for about 10 years or so, became a county mental health director. And somewhere in the 80s, the county commissioners in Oregon said, a number of them said, we looked at our system, and we've got a county health director and a county mental health director. We got two, we want one. And so I was put over in charge of public health, mental health, and environmental health, and a couple other things on the side. And that's how I got involved in public health. And like most of us who did that, who jumped from one to the other and ended up doing both, when I looked back over it, most of those men and women became more interested in public health and mental health like I did. So I did that for about 10 years. I was the head of our state organization of county health departments, and got involved in political stuff with the legislature and what have you, joined the APHA nursing section, and eventually went to work at the state health division and worked with county health departments. I was the representative to what back then called the Association of State and Territorial Directors of Nursing, and now it's the Association of Public Health Nurses. So I got involved with some national organizations, and I also was fortunate enough to be in about the second or third class of the National Public Health Leadership Institute back, must have been the early 90s, and that really sort of helped me understand how leaders thought and what you could do and what, probably more importantly, what you couldn't do, and that's probably enough about how I ended up here today. Oh, you asked how I got involved in environmental health. So I want to say the early aughts, 2000, 2005, I sort of had this hard conversation with myself and said, well, I got this job. I'm going to work on it another 10 years. But, you know, what do you want to do with the last 10 years of your life? You know, you live the biblical score. Was it 3 score and 10? So you have to have an honest conversation. And I said to myself, well, there's these issues out there that I really think I need to be at least aware of and maybe doing some advocacy for. And so I asked the APHA nursing section if they would form an environmental committee. I asked ASTDN if they would form an environmental committee. And they both said yes. Eventually, once the Alliance of Nurses for Healthy Environments formed, we were able, about 10 years ago, we were able to ask both of those organizations, ASTDN and APHA, to let Annie serve as the subcommittees for those two organizations. And I said to myself, you know, I can imagine the people standing over my grave, you know, down in the future and saying, why didn't you blankety blank? And they're going to be saying things like, I think four main things, the maldistribution of wealth, the extinction of species, this chemical stew that we float around in, and global warming. And I kind of said to myself, I'm not an expert in any of those things, but I need to keep my finger on the pulse of all four of those.
Wow, that's super interesting, Tom. So you've been a real leader in the nation in terms of helping to launch two important aspects of environmental health nursing, one being the environmental health piece of APHA nursing, and the other being ANNIE, Alliance of Nurses for Healthy Environments. Congratulations to you, and thank you for that leadership over the last, sounds like, 20, 25 years, maybe.
Well, that's nice of you to say it that way, Beth, but I really wouldn't consider myself a leader of those things. You know, you sort of raise your hand and say something out loud, and you know, people want to join in because they're already to join in. It's not about leading them anywhere. It's like I think Bismarck said that statesmen really can't influence events. They simply wait for God to be walking through them and grab onto his or her hem of his skirt. So I don't consider myself a leader on those, but I was fortunate to be around when you say something out loud and there's other people who want to do stuff.
Yeah,
like
that's
an APHA nursing section, Beth Lamana, she really took that and ran with it there. I got to give her credit. And Barb Sadler and you and Kathy Curtis and all the rest of you.
Yeah, cool. I want to follow up a little bit on your, I love your pulling out of these four issues that you feel like are really crucial right now. And I believe you said the maldistribution of wealth, extinction of species, all the chemical exposures we have, and global warming. Is that right?
Yeah.
So I want to connect a little bit more, or have you connect, put it into words a bit more about your long-term experience, both with mental health and with public health, and how these issues are related. I mean, I have my own ideas, but how would you relate these issues to that history of your work?
So dialing back a little bit, back when I was more public health and before the environmental health that you're talking about, I was fortunate enough to, in my county, to do the first secondhand smoke ordinance that got passed in the state of Oregon that banned worker exposure to tobacco in all workplaces, including bars and taverns. We started the first breast and cervical cancer coalition in the state. We started the David Olds home visiting program before it was really a program out there like Nurse Family Partnership, just because a nurse came to me and said, I read this research, we got to do it. So I had that experience with advocacy, sort of how people make decisions, how things get done. And like looking at the tobacco thing, I realized in getting the tobacco ordinance passed that the truth is, I didn't need to get every citizen in the county behind it. I just need to get 5 votes on the city council. And of course, I wasn't prepared. So unknown to me, we were the first ones in the state to do this. And first is always easy. Second is a little easier. Third is really hard. But first was easy because the opposition wasn't prepared. But we had the meeting where the hearing's taking place at the council and testimony is given both ways. And not very strong on the anti. And unbeknownst to me, I hadn't done enough research to know that if the council passed something unanimously, there wouldn't be a subsequent meeting. So they passed it unanimously and we were done. And that's not a direct answer to those four issues, but it gave me confidence that it really is okay to raise your hand in a whole variety of settings and say, there's something wrong with the world we live in. If 1% of the people in the United States have 40% of the wealth, 20% of the income, and that is not going to bode well for us. And so when we try to pass a tax measure in Oregon, I'm there. If there's those kind of things come up at the county level, I'm there. I try to weigh in on that. And I had this idea that for each of those issues, maybe for many, as nurses, we really need to try and think of, what am I going to do in my personal life? What am I going to do in my professional life? And what am I going to do in my policy life? So it's easiest for me to think about, of those four, global warming. It's harder for me to think about that with extinction of species, although I think it's a very serious problem issue coming. And it's in kind of middle ground for me to think about what to do in those three areas, personal, professional, and policy, with this stew of chemicals that we are in part because, like I said, I'm not environmentally trained. So I have to really trust people like Kathy Curtis on Annie to inform me all along what's the right stance on chemicals. Global warming, I'm a little, it's a little easier for me to get to that because it doesn't necessarily require a PhD to think about it. But the answer, my long rambling answer to your question is for those issues, I try to think about personal policy and professional aspects for me. And I could give you examples if that would help a little bit. You know, I'm standing in my kitchen and my daughter's becoming vegan and her vegan friend says something like, we're vegan, we don't eat honey. Oh, God, you know, I'm sort of roll my eyes at that. And she says, we don't do leather. I get that. And then she says, we don't do wool. What are you talking about? And she says, well, we don't do wool because it's an animal product. And I said, well, what about the footprint of wool versus other materials? And she looked at me and I looked at her and I realized at that point that I was more ignorant than smart. I had only said the thing. So I sort of go out and try to noodle around and figure out what has the largest carbon footprint. Is it wool or is it cotton? And sure enough, somebody out there has analyzed it from top to bottom. And it turns out that, at least in this one analysis that I read, they're about the same, but for very, very different reasons. And the carbon footprint of the cotton has mostly to do with all the times that you wash it. You wash them over and over again, and it's all the power associated with that. It's putting aside completely pesticides and those other things, just the carbon footprint. The carbon footprint of wool has to do with the gases given off by the sheep. And so they're very different things. So that sort of personal question in the kitchen led me to think about sort of what are the policy implications? How am I going to think about the ruminants out there and how they give off gas? You know, how does that going to play into one of top 10 things to do internationally to reduce carbon footprint is to move to a plant-based diet. So it helped me think about policy and personal items, that sort of wool versus cotton conversation. Another one that was similar was I got this iPad. I'm reading in the New York Times every week where they ask the person who's the author that they're talking to, do you read ebooks or not? And so I said to myself, well, I got this iPad and I'm reading ebooks. You know, what's the carbon footprint for my iPad? And is that different than the carbon footprint of the trees that are made for these books that I'm reading? So sure enough, that's just the personal question. I was able to find somebody has done that analysis and walked through the iPad, this world, and analyzed what the footprint of those devices are, and compared that to the carbon footprint of cutting down trees and making paper and what have you. And they cranked out a number of books to read on your iPad that if you read those number of books, you've probably done the good thing and saved more carbon than if you were reading all those books on paper. However, at the end of the analysis, the author, bless her heart or his heart, said, well, really the best thing to do is to walk to the library and check out the book. So again, it was this sort of personal dilemma that I used to try and inform me about issues that then come up in public policy. How do we make things? What's the footprint of those things we make and how does that interact with just our personal life and our like transportation? I rambled. Okay.
That's great. Yeah, that's terrific rambling and really good examples about how we as human beings start to weave together these impacts that we make in our daily lives. And you know, I'm sitting here with you on Skype with two computers open. I mean, it becomes such an intense use of things, both electronic and otherwise. And so, you know, I think it's so important always to try and remember, well, what is my impact? What is the best way to approach things? This is something that I try and do in nursing practice in hospitals. What is our impact? And how do we start to think sensibly, just like you've described, about our practice choices in acute care? Because they too have different footprints from the chemicals, the packaging that comes, how what happens to the stuff after you dispose of it, the energy that's used in while something is being used. And it is not scientific yet. I've argued for some time that this needs to be a focus area, an area of expertise in nursing, which really has to do with the footprints, more or less, of our practice choices. But it's exactly like you say, that when you encounter it in your daily life or in your daily work, to just have that in your mind is, I think, such a helpful attitude, because partly it takes you to answers, as you've
that's
been able
a great
to
that's
find.
A great review, Beth. I do admit that, you know, my name is Thomas, so there's a little doubting that goes on, and I do despair a little bit. I'm convinced that at the end of this, if civilization makes it, you know, a couple hundred years from now, there'll be some things that they'll look back on us and roll their eyes and say, you know, those petrochemicals were so valuable, we can't believe you burned them. But on the other hand, this world that's going to be in place for our great, great, great grandchildren and nieces and what have you, it's going to consume less energy. And so when I do the walk around, like you just described, and I look at, you know, I get all these I get kids, and so I get all these computers and iPads and iPhones, and everything's charging them. I don't even have to have a nightlight on in the house anymore because everything's charging. And so there will be less energy consumed. And when I see that people report that they can make environmental changes as a policy level across a great geographic area, and it's had no impact on energy consumption, I kind of say to myself, well, that may not be true. Let's just wait and see, like you said, the science. Let's see if that's really going to happen.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? I'm vexed by the question that you hinted at. My way of saying it is, are we going to get out of this? How are we going to get through this very interesting point in time where, as you say, we're burning through hundreds of millions of years worth of stored energy in a few centuries, and we can see what's happening. I'm constantly fascinated with that question.
Well, I am too. I was reading this book the other day on a guy went down the full length of the Colorado River, reported all the way along about the communities and the river and the plants and what have you. But somewhere in there, he had a throwaway line where he said, efficiencies don't always help. And he said, planes, for example, that airplane fuel is much more efficient than it used to be. However, because it got more efficient, people fly more. We're probably consuming more. Mm-hmm. So I found guy or gal somewhere at the federal government. It took me a while to find this, who could show me the data set that would tell you how much gasoline is pumped at the pump. Because I believe that we need to keep this stuff in the ground, in regards to how efficient the cars are. We need to keep it in the ground. And sure enough, I found it. And when I looked at it, so for example, Montana, starting back in about, I think, 1980 or something, the consumption in your state in Montana was about 1,500 gallons per day, I think is what the number was, something like that. And then it bumps up, and now it's about 2,000. So it's like cars have got more efficient, but we love it. And like Dan Rather said, Americans will put up with anything as long as it doesn't block traffic. So I despair a little bit, you know, and I think we need to keep our eye on the ball.
Yeah.
The global warming, it is an existential crisis. And I think to the extent that we can say that out loud without discouraging people from trying to do something about it, we will be better off. I, like you said, I think the chances of, I shouldn't say us, because, you know, it's not going to be you and I, it's going to be a couple, three generations from now. Getting out of this is really 50-50. And, you know, you'd have to be insane to get in the car and drive anywhere thinking your chances of not dying are 50-50. So I think we have to say that out loud, and we have to not be shy about saying it. And at the same time, we have to say there are ways to fix this. They're not going to be necessarily pleasant or fun, except to the extent that we save our Earth and we save life for future generations. But for us, it's not going to be fun. I say to my children, I said, your grandchildren, unless they're really, really wealthy, will probably never eat a piece of beef. It's just, the world just, at 7 billion people going to 12, it just isn't going to feed people with beef. Probably with pork, maybe not even with chickens. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. I think of it sometimes in relation to wood. This is an analogy, but you know, when you see an older building or tear down an older building, it's these super solid timbers from your part of the world, you know, from these giant trees that were just cut in whole pieces. And now so very often it's glued pieces of wood glued together in either glue lamps or even more so particle board type of things, which is well made. I'm not saying it's not well made, but it's just so interesting because we have burnt through basically our large yes. tree stores. So it's I wanted to follow just a little bit because a little bit more about climate change, particularly and health messaging and nursing as a voice for climate change. And you've been part of this, I realize, and Annie does a really good job of leading nurses in the country about this. And so first of all, you know, nurses have this really trusted voice. Nurses can explain things well. Nurses always have good stories and experience with particular individuals who've experienced something related, some health issue that's related. And then secondly, the message about health and climate seems to be one that resonates with people because everybody knows someone with asthma. Everybody knows someone with heart disease. What are your thoughts on that, especially from a public health nurse perspective, in terms of effective education or messaging or communication about climate change and health?
Well, I don't think I can answer that question very well because, again, most of this isn't my area of expertise. But I do think that the nurses are the only profession that's educated neuron to neighborhood and cell to community, that has that full breadth and is able to articulate from the cellular level to the individual level to the community level, and if they want to the policy level about these things. So that's sort of my first thought on it. My second thought about nursing and these issues is that I think there are really only two professions that there's a lot of them across the country, and they're trusted by people. Nurses are the only ones that end up in the Gallup poll. But I think the K-12 teachers and nurses are the ones that are in every community. They're loved by their community. They're loved by most everyone, and they're trusted. It's not surprising that both those professions are mostly women, and they're trusted. So I think those are the two professions that really are able, if they want to stand up and talk about the issues. The messaging part, I think, is tough. You know, George Washington said in that letter to Lafayette that one of the, he might use the word evil, one of the evils of democracy is the people must feel before they know. So I do think there is a stage of talking and feeling before everyone can know what the right thing is to do. I think we've seen that with the same-sex marriage stuff, you know, over 10 years or so. Everybody, you know, the polls are such that everybody is okay with all of that now, the vast majority. And it's because, you know, we know somebody, we feel it, we see them, you know, and we feel, and now we know. So I think that is a key part of the messaging everywhere. But the second part of the messaging is not to forget that decisions are made by people who make decisions, and we can't shy away from holding them accountable for that. And we have to remember that access and action are very different things. And talking to my legislator and him or her giving me time to do that is one thing, but I need to really be cognizant of how he or she votes on an important issue and then dial back and say, great, you did it, or shame on you for not. So I think there's the one piece which is about messaging everywhere, and not to forget, though, that it's important to keep on top of the people who make decisions.
Yeah, that's great advice, and particularly those at the local level. I mean, all the way up, but it's a unique opportunity, I think, because oftentimes in communities, you really do know the people; they really do know you.
That's a good point. And I'm going to interrupt a little bit because I know we're running out of time.
Yeah,
I'm gonna try this primary session. I think influencing local politicians, and I'm counting state ones as local, is at the primary time. That's really when you have the town meetings. They're anxious about not getting elected. And so I think at the primary level, which for us comes up in May, I think, that's the time when you can really ask them hard questions. And I think this primary session, I'm going to try asking everybody who's running for office four or five key questions, but the one relevant to our discussion today is, would you support a across-the-board carbon tax? And I know that I will hear back from, you know, the guy running for the local school board and the gal running for the transportation bus district and the recreation district, and I'll hear back from them, well, that's not my concern. And I'm going to say back to them, listen, you're running for office, you're a leader, people listen to you, and for all I know, you're going to run for another office someday, so I want to know now what you think about it. And so I'm going to start asking the people those questions that before I always said to myself, well, why would I ask them that? Because that's not where they make the decision. But I want to know now how they think, and I want to start to use that. And many of them are really community leaders, and so there's no reason they wouldn't say, yeah, that seems like a good idea. And they're leaders. So I'm going to start trying that this spring and see what happens.
That's a great idea. Because whether or not it's something they vote directly on, you're exactly right, their influence will matter and will nudge a larger group in a direction. I want to follow up on another thing you said earlier, which is about extinction. And I know that you said that it's a harder place for you to get into the weeds about. But I too really struggle with this as in the end as another health concern. You know, I think global warming is pushing extinction, but I think extinction itself is a problem. Again, related to our actions, but not only from climate change, from our use of land, our rules about what species should be preserved or not, our damage to soils, you know, and the microbial species. And I feel like it's really hard to talk about because it's difficult to draw specific linear connections. And so people think, you know, often, well, that's just too big a problem. That's out there. But I'm quite concerned about extinction loss as one of the rudders kind of how the ecosystem works. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't have much more thoughts than what you just said. I agree with you completely. And I'm trying to educate myself a little as much as I can beyond, I forgot her name, Colbert, the Sixth Extinction book that she wrote, and it was in the New Yorker before that. Trying to keep myself educated about that and understand what that means in the United States, and trying to understand what that means globally. I do get that for these problems that we're just articulated, that one of the issues we have to keep in mind is what's going to happen internationally, and so the global South. We can't think that the global South is not going to want to modernize. And so I do get the deforestation in Brazil and what have you is a big deal and species loss there. But on the other hand, those people have a right to a modern life too. And so I don't know more than what you said, other than I feel kind of helpless in trying to understand how that's going to play out. Probably different than in my neighborhood, but more as an international or at least a hemispheric issue.
Yeah, thank you. That's helpful.
Sounds like you know a lot more about it than I do.
Well, not so much, but you know, before nursing, my studies were in ecosystem issues, really. My first degree was in botany, and so it's always there in my mind, and I feel like we are part of our ecosystems, and of course ecosystems are balanced, they're homeostatic, they're responsive to other parts of this very complex system. So you go messing with it, and pretty soon you've created a lot of problems, which of course we have.
I suspect that we've had a little, the shadow of this kind of walked by us with the die off of the bees, and you know, to the extent we were thinking about that and paying attention to that, and whether that was caused by a disease or you know our interference. It doesn't matter. It still is the shadow of how things can just crumble quickly if certain species go away, and then also if we don't have access to species down the road. I think the bee die-off was a canary in the mine, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. I have taken a lot of your time, but I do want to ask you one more thing, and it's really about you as a retired nurse, and I'm so interested in your interests and love that you're very engaged and involved, and I know that from my work with you on the Annie board and also with APHA. What wisdom do you have to those of us who have not yet retired about how to use your time well? I liked your statement early on that you said, I need to take stock of how I'm going to spend the rest of my years. What else would you say about that?
Well, I do think that's the most important question. And when I was still working at the health division and people would come to me about retiring and talk, I don't know why, some people would talk to me about it. And the conversation would often take the form of them saying, I don't know if I'm going to be able to live like I want to live if I retire. And I would say to them, you know, I do think there is this capitalistic cultural fear that's put in us that we won't be able to make it financially down the road. And I would say to them, I bet that really isn't true for you. You're a smart person. You can figure it out. I'd say to them, when I worked on tobacco stuff, I worked for county commissioners and, you know, ended up getting fired in part because of that and took a large pay cut and life went on and did other things. And so I'd say to them, you know, I think that's the culture telling you that you're not going to be able to do it. That was the first thing I would say to them. Second thing I would say to them is the 10-year thing. I said, you really have to think about what you want to do the last 10 years of your life, because after 35, 40, your health, you're either lucky or you're not, you know. And so planning to retire and do stuff between 70 and 80 is probably not the most rational way to think about it. You really need to be thinking about between 60 and 70 or 55 and 65. And I've dialed back to the same thing, but I think that's the second thing. The third thing is that from everything I've read, keeping active both cognitively and physically is an important thing. So I've appreciated that Annie and APHA and advisory board that I'm on, and I'm co-chair of our state Future of Nursing Campaign for Action, Robert Wood Johnson thing, and I appreciate that those groups have let this old guy participate, and I've tried to keep in mind that you know, the I can bring to those things some experience and connections that I've had over the years, and that can be valuable. But I also have to bring to the meet to the, those things the ability to keep my mouth shut and I'll be sitting there and someone will say, well, I think we should do such and such. And I'll say to myself, well, I can remember we tried that 20 years ago and maybe it'll work now, but I bet not. As an old person, you just have to be quiet many, many times. And I, So I've appreciated that people have let me participate, and I've tried to bring those two things to that, both some experience, which is what it is, and also the ability to know when to say something and when not to.
Well, I think you do that quite well, Tom, and you bring not only perspective and wisdom, but always a good sense of humor too. All right. Well, thanks again, Tom. And thank you all for listening to the Nurses for Healthy Environments podcast. Check us out at environ.org. And please leave a review for us wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, and talk to you next time.